Good morning and welcome to the Preventing Grace podcast for, I'm just going to check the calendar. I think this one's going to be for September 23rd.
We're actually pre-recording it. We're doing back-to-back pre-recordings
because we're awesome.
Yeah, and we have like this time to do it because our children are in homeschool soccer, which means no practice or skill. And they're here 2 hours every Saturday morning doing their stuff.
But and only we're in for the car. 7 weeks.
And so you might notice our sound quality being better because we're in an enclosed, airtight environment.
Yes.
Our car. And
I just also want to note, like, so people don't think our children are pagan. Part of homeschool soccer is Bible time. They're not allowed to play soccer until they've heard from the Word of God. Although I'm a little stressed because the person doing Bible time is the King James only person.
Oh, dear.
And I feel
she really?
Upset that, like, she shouldn't be teaching the Bible.
Oh, she's teaching children, so it's okay.
Yeah, but my son is 13. And there are men.
Oh, he's almost a man, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, but biblically speaking, he is a man.
He is a man.
He's gotten his bar mitzvah done.
And we didn't do that.
Yeah.
But also there are fathers who bring their children to homeschool soccer. So, I think that's a little sketchy.
Yeah, yeah, because she's a woman.
Yeah.
Is she wearing a long skirt?
No. She wears trousers.
Oh, my goodness.
And her head is uncovered. There are a lot of other mothers here who would never wear trousers and whose heads are covered.
What would she say?
I'm a little...
What does she say from the King James Version? I've never heard her teach.
I mean, I can't... Oh, it's something about being a good... The whole 7 weeks, they're going to be talking about Timothy being approved and being a good example. And how it's easier to understand things when you show somebody how to do it rather than just shouting at them.
Well, that's a good lesson.
It is a great lesson. I felt convicted during Bible time myself because my preferred method is shouting. She's actually a really, really lovely person, and she organizes the soccer, which means she's going straight to heaven without any stops. Whereas I hope I get to go there. Some people probably worry that I'm not going to make it. So we, last week, which was literally 3 minutes ago,
sorry,
we're talking about pain. But we want to talk this time about the books that we've been reading.
Right. It's a kind of a timeless podcast.
It's a timeless podcast. So whatever is happening on September 23rd.
Yeah.
It won't matter.
Well, if it's breaking news, like some big, huge, massive thing
Maybe
takes
we'll
place, we can
another.
Save this for another time. But yeah. So we should start by saying what we're reading as a family, because we started family reading time last year, which makes us incredibly functional and
holy.
Right. So if you're not doing it, I hope you feel really guilty.
You should feel
this
bad.
The first part of the podcast is dedicated to make families that are not reading together feel...
If you don't read together...
Shame.
Yeah. What kind of family are you?
Are your kids going to grow up and just never have that cozy memory of sitting together?
While father reads. From a holy book. What is the virtuous and godly book that we're reading together as a family?
It's by P.G. Woodhouse, and it's...
Is it Uncle Dynamite?
It's Uncle Dynamite, yeah.
And it's so funny.
It really is good. I was suspicious about... I had never read P.G. Woodhouse until we started starting our family reading time, and I've been won over. I was, you know what it was? I never thought, except for Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and Tom Clancy when I was younger, I always thought reading novels was a waste of time, reading fiction was a waste of time, because you're not really getting anything out of it. You're just entertaining yourself. It's like, you know...
Eating sugar.
Yeah, you're spending a lot of time just doing nothing. The way really good writers write is super helpful to
actually. The point of novels is the unveiling of truth.
Yeah, and it's
I don't know why you didn't know that.
I knew that, but I heard.
So one of the main truths that's unveiled in Uncle Dynamite is that you shouldn't marry a strong, independent woman because
she'll take all of your fun things away. All the things you like to do.
She'll make you get up at 6 o'clock in the morning
and be a teetotaler.
I love how Woodhouse really hates female novelists. Like, there's only one good female, like, not evil female novelist in all of his books that I remember, and that's Rosie Anne Banks. And even she is kind of a sergeant major. She keeps Bingo on a pretty tight rope. But pretty much female novelists in Woodhouse are have a basilisk eye.
So. But it's incredibly funny, and it you know one good of it is it does teach your kids real humor, and.
But also, I think it shows them what they should look for in love.
It does do that in an interesting way,
like
right?
If you're worried about who your children are going to marry, which I worry about all the time because I'm going to be related to whoever it is that they're become related to.
Read them P.G. Woodhouse.
Yeah, because you don't want to be like, I want you to make a list. Who does God have for you? No, you want them to have sort of a plumb line, or just like a kind of person that their soul leaps towards.
Right.
And you don't want that person to be difficult or unkind or uncharitable or become a difficult aunt.
Right.
Or too soppy.
Yeah.
Like Madeline, do you really want your child to marry Madeline Bassett?
Who we're told all the time by Wooster is something to look at.
Yeah. So it makes you think this person is so beautiful, but what's underneath? It's the gentle way of getting your child to think about whatever is lovely and true and all those things in Philippians or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I think. It's the indirect approach to relationship advice.
I think that's true. It works.
So, okay, but what are you reading? You go first.
Let's see. I am reading several nonfiction books at the same time as I'm reading fictional book.
You're reading a really great book that is universally known to
The
be
The Nine
a
Tailors
book.
By Dorothy Sayers. Yes. Who I also discovered recently on our because of Audible and our trip.
Yeah.
Our vacation. She's great. She's a really good writer.
I know, it's so amazing. it's like saying this Narnia book by C.S. Lewis is really great. Have you heard about Aslan? And the rest of Christianity is like, yes.
Well, okay, I heard.
We literally have been reading this for 100 years.
Okay, I knew a little bit about Dorothy Sayers, you know, but not Christian writer, woman.
You know, that's
writes mysteries and all of those things except for the Christian writer part.
The woman part is
didn't
what
interest
you're
me. Yeah, I don't. I guess I feel like Woodhouse. I've never been drawn to women
writers.
Authors.
Okay, well that see. You should not say that out loud. How dare you? You need to get on Twitter right now and ask for people to suggest to you women writers that you can follow on Twitter. How dare you?
I just
you?
Don't want to hear their voices.
How dare you?
I'm just kidding.
don't value the voice of women. What kind of person are you? A bad person. Yeah. I just need to say it out loud with my voice.
So anyway, but they're really good mysteries. She's really good mystery novelist.
Yes.
And
it's like, the awe in your voice is so reprehensible right now.
and she loves the church. She seems to be a little Anglo-Catholic, I think. But she loves the church, and so the Nine Tailors, my goodness, I think I'm in chapter like 100 pages in, and I know about the transepts and the histories of the bells and about the vicar's daily, you know, routine, and it's all, you know, this woman had a deep and abiding love and affection for the church stuff, and man, the detail about the bells, I'm sure there's a reason for it, but... And the ringing
of
the bells.
Well, no, I think part of it is that she was really obsessed and had to write a whole novel.
Okay.
Because
the Nine Tailors are nine church bells, and the book starts with Peter Whimsey and his Bunter. Is it
Bunter?
Bunter. They drive off the road in a winter storm, and they have to take shelter in a village nearby, and they happen to stay with the vicar. And it happens to be, I think it's, what, Christmas Eve or something? And
New Year's Eve.
And so they have to ring bells from what? From...
like all night.
Yeah, from like 9 o'clock and in the evening until the morning. 24 hours of bell ringing. Mm-hmm. Like, so you get 9 guys up there just ringing and ringing and ringing mm-hmm. and ringing. And the kind of ringing of the bells they do isn't...
like hymns.
Isn't like hymns or, some kind of melody. It's this...
complicated mathematical pattern.
Right. That we learn about in depth in this book.
Yeah. But you're liking it.
I am liking it. It's fun. I mean, we finally have a murder, so we can...
Okay,
it took about 100 pages to have anything, any death take place. But so, yeah, I'm enjoying that book. It's fun. I still feel guilty when I read it, though. I feel like I'm... because most of my other books I read, except for the... I can usually count as work. I'm studying to gain knowledge to show myself approved. But
this is
a sheer pleasure.
Nobody else feels guilty by reading Dorothy Sayers because she's intelligent. She's a strong, independent woman. In our family, those people are called SIWs. They're universally maligned. In fact, if you're offered to go watch a movie, if you offer a child to go watch a movie, that child will say, "Is there an SIW?"
Right.
And you're like, "Yeah, it's probably..."
It's the trope.
And then they're like, "Never mind, I don't care about Marvel anymore."
That's why Wonder Woman didn't quite make the hit that... in the end game, when the strong, independent women...
yeah.
...did our, most of the work.
Our kids are like, "Oh my gosh, so boring." Okay, so I'm reading... a fun book that I'm reading right now is An Innocent Anthropologist Abroad. And it's the field study of Nigel Barley. I should have read this when I was much younger, but I didn't, so I feel guilty. But it's so funny and fascinating because this man from Oxford or Cambridge or somewhere goes to do his field work, his anthropology field work, and lives with the Joyas in Cameroon. And it has a miserable time for 2 years. Funny.
You described it like...
Well, Gerald Durrell.
Right, except for anthropologists.
endorsed it, which probably made it a bestseller in England, because if you're Gerald Durrell, you... whatever you write and whatever
explain
you
who
read...
Gerald Durrell is for our Philistines.
So, Gerald Durrell is somebody you should read. His most famous book is My Family and Other Animals, in which it's a 5-year sojourn that his family has on the island of Corfu when he's 10. And it's so funny and brilliant. And not Christian at all. But if you're looking for somebody to describe the natural world in a Christian way...
Gerald Durrell
does it without being a Christian. So, and that's what I'm enjoying about An Innocent Anthropologist Abroad, is that the curiosity...
Is he a Christian?
No. No, in fact, he runs into a lot of missionaries.
Yeah.
And he needs them. He needs them because he's alone in this village. And he's sick and sad, and his money doesn't come through, and he has nothing to read, and he's working really hard, but he's eating... I don't know, yams or cassava or something, and he's
miserable.
And he goes to this haven where the missionaries, he can't understand why they're there and why they're so cheerful. And they befriend him and take care of him and give him money and help him. And I think he's a help to them because they're trying to work with the same people, but without the anthropological skill that he has. So he's putting together the worldview of this people group and trying to understand how it is that they conceive of the world. And it's excellent. So funny. It's very old-timey.
It has lots of circumcision, doesn't it?
Yeah, that particular culture thinks about everything from the perspective of male circumcision. And nothing that they do doesn't in some way refer back to circumcision.
And I don't as think I'm reading, be a very I painful think like there's culture to live in. The poor men in that culture.
Because they're circumcised in groups. Some
they're not circumcised as babies.
No, there'd be like teenagers. Oh, but then if you're on the older end of that particular group, you could be maybe like 20. And there's certain things you can't do until you've been circumcised. And then you have your circumcision brothers. So what's so interesting and what many missionaries feel is they're studying other cultures is how God has embedded Christ in different cultures.
Right.
And there's Nigel Barley seeing, really articulating categories which a Christian would come in with the Bible and say, there's Jesus waiting for you. And he doesn't know that, of course. So, but the way the circumcision, your circumcision brothers, and what you have to do when your brother dies, and how you have to take care of each other is really fascinating. So,
I'm still.
But there's a lot of.
I didn't know they had a
trauma.
Circumcised at 20. Oh my goodness.
Or maybe.
See, this is why Judaism didn't spread like wildfire among.
Yes.
Among Greeks and Romans.
Yes.
It's why you had like huge crowds of God fearers, but not yet.
Nobody wanted to convert. Yes. So that's what I'm reading, and I'm past the halfway part mark. Okay, your turn.
Let's see. One of the bigger nonfiction books that I'm working through slowly is the history of Dien Bien Phu, which is is the climactic battle between the French and the Viet Minh in the 1950s, before the Vietnam War, when the Americans were involved. And the French used to, the Indochina or Vietnam used to be a French colony, and the Viet Minh were mostly communist, or they were communists, but they were popular because they were also seen as nationalists, and so lots of Vietnamese joined them, and the French were coming off humiliation in World War II. I mean, total humiliation of a large, 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 large number of the populace sympathizing with and supporting the Nazis within the Vichy government and even the people themselves, deporting Jews, all kinds of things that, and I know, you know, they're really sensitive about that. So a lot of myths about the resistance started to crop up. Oh yeah, we were, and every Frenchman was a member of the resistance. Yeah. And it was a lot of, you know, national shame. So the French were not really eager to give up their colonies after World War II. They wanted to hold on to those things because it was a matter of national pride.
Yeah.
And so when they felt Indochina pulling out of their grasp, they really fought hard for it. And they, Dien Bien Phu was a battle that was took place in a large valley in the northern part of Vietnam, and at that point all the major cities were still in the French hands, Hanoi and Saigon, and it was a parachute regiment or a parachute operation, because there were no good roads there, so they dropped a whole bunch of parachute regiments, battalions, in to this valley. They created a base, set down an airfield, and the idea was it was going to be like an outward spur from which you can run other operations. And what they didn't expect was that the Viet Minh were capable of dragging large pieces of artillery up the massive hills and embedding them, and they didn't think that the Viet Minh would amass so many people to oppose this beachhead, this landing, and they did it. There's 30,000 Viet Minh. Mm. Troops, I think at the greatest extent it's 45,000 against at most, I believe, 8,000 French, but that fluctuated from 3,000 to 8,000, right, depending on things. And because they occupied the Viet Minh occupied the hills, you couldn't fly in supplies very well. That's the only way to supply the camp was to airdrop them, and pretty soon the runway became, well, because pretty soon the runway was unusable, and so they'd have to airdrop supplies in, and the French were divided into, you know, eight or nine, or six or seven, I think, little strongholds within the valley, which were one by one overrun. And so they call for volunteers, more people to parachute in. And Frenchmen volunteered knowing that they were going to die. The last month, people knew it was a death. You're just not going to come out of there if you go in. But the French paratroopers, to their credit, you know, jumped in.
Wow.
Lots of them did.
Wow.
And, it's a really tragic, tragic story. And they did well. I mean, they fought. They killed far, 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 they tried twice as many or three times as many Viet Minh as they themselves suffered. But in the end, the whole camp was overrun. And a lot of people were captured, but more people were killed. And the people who were captured, a lot of them died in captivity. And
gosh.
Yeah, it was a horrible, horrible thing. But that it was an important battle because it piqued the U.S.'s interest in what's going on in Vietnam. And it was just at the point when American strategists were thinking globally about the communist threat, and thinking to themselves, "Now wait a minute, what happens here if this whole country goes red?" You know,
wow.
So they otherwise, you know, America up to that point had been very anti-colonialist. We would never support colonies because we were a colony, you know.
Yeah.
But there was material support for the French all the way through,
wow,
which was seen as, you know, hypocritical by a lot of countries that looked on America as the model of how you defeat the oppressor and throw off the shackles of an empire. And here we're helping the imperialists because of communism. We're worried about communism. So anyway, it's a fascinating book. I thought it was kind of boring. I'm really... you look like your eyes are glazing over as I'm
talking about. No, I'm fascinated. I'm grateful that you're reading it so that I don't have to.
Yeah.
Praise God. Because there's no way I would ever read that book.
Yeah.
So, I'm reading, I mentioned it last time, No Soft Incense, Barbara Pym in the Church. This is really, really great book. I love it. And I just want to read. I have really nothing to say about it except that I have a quote that's really great. Oh goodness, I should have found it before you stopped so suddenly. So it does mini history of Anglo-Catholicism, history of churches that she went to. Okay, here it is. A lot of people in her books go over to Roman Catholicism from Anglicanism. That's always going on. She comments on that here and there. As for the main reasons for departures from her North London congregation, this was Barbara herself, not one of her characters. Barbara listed Rome, death, and umbrage. And the greatest of these is umbrage.
That's great.
So the whole book is like that. It's excellent. I like Barbara Pym because she loves the church too. You're never going to read Barbara Pym, but you should, because they're books that really get to the heart of Anglicanism.
Well, you know, if it's something you think we should read, we should do it at family reading time so that I can...
I'm sure our children would love.
You don't think that.
Excellent women. this is really a nice book. I got it for my birthday, and I'm reading it slowly whenever I have to go anywhere. And... see, the problem is I just finished Modern Kinship, so I haven't really... And I have a big book on shame that I'm about to start. And I'm reading another novel, The Battle of Villa Fiorita.
Which, sadly, it's not about a battle, is it?
No, it's not about a battle. It's about a woman who leaves her husband and goes off with an Italian actor. And her children, who are like, I don't know, 10 and 12... leave their home in England without telling anyone and travel by train and go to Italy to get their mother back from the clutches of this person. And that's the battle for her. And I'm only in the first chapter, so okay. I don't know. I was a lot triggered by the adultery. I had a hard time with the first chapter.
Was it vivid?
No, no, not that. Just that, because, you know, some people have committed adultery in the church, and it's really upsetting for everyone when that happens. And,
yes.
So just the description of her going off and her unhappiness and her everything.
Is it written by a Christian?
I don't know. I don't know anything. The author, which a lot of people have told me to read, is Rumor Garden, and I don't know anything about her. I haven't read about her yet, and this is my first book, and she's well-loved writer, so I'm not sure. Speaking of women writing, it's really upsetting to me that you would just discount the female novelist the way that P.G. Wodehouse does, and that's because women are good novelists, but I find that when I'm reading a man who's writing a woman character, I get easily frustrated and angry. The only writer who can write a female voice character is Alexander McCall Smith, and Anthony Trollope writes an excellent woman.
You said P.G. Wodehouse does, and...
Well, no, but, like, gets it, like real, he doesn't like, get into the... stuff. Yeah, more serious. The actual soul of a female person. Anthony Trollope does that really well, and so does Alexander McCall Smith. But it bothers me that they can do it so well, and it bothers me when other people try to do it. Okay, that's all I have. And you should have one last book, because our children are going to be done with soccer soon.
Oh, okay. Well, let's see. Last one is by Hans Boersma, who is a theologian who teaches at Regent. And it's weaving... No, it's a... Oh, Sacred Tapestry. What is it called? I hate that. The title just went off the top of my head. It is...
Sacred...
Participation.
Sacred...
Heavenly Participation. Heavenly Participation, yes. That's what it is. It's really interesting book. He thinks that on both sides of the Reformation, both on the... He's Reformed, but he says both on the Reform side and on the Roman side, we've cut ourselves off from what he calls sacramental way of looking at life, right? It's sacramental ontology, where all the material world is really a means by which you interact with the maker, the creator, and then life is imbued with spiritual meaning, and not just within, but in the material things that are around us. Mm-hmm. And he says, you know, the sacraments themselves are of course the chief means by which there are these material things are the chief means by which we take hold of the sacred and God, or the, not and God, God
by which the
we
sacred.
By which we take hold of God. I sound like a that sounds very Episcopalian,
yes,
didn't it?
Yeah. Yes, you were like teetering on the brink there.
Right, and he says, well, you know, one of the things that the medieval church had that we don't have is that they had thoroughly integrated Platonic thinking into their the worldview of the church, and they did it critically. They didn't accept everything, of course, from the Plato or the Neoplatonists or Plotinus or anything, but they successfully harmonized it with the biblical Christian worldview. And Plato, Platonic thought, is what wins this kind of sacramental view such power, he says. So we need to go. He's thinking the book is all about how we recapture that. Now, of course, if everything is a sacrament, nothing's a sacrament. So you got to be careful down that line. I find it's a fascinating book, and he's Anglican. He's Reformed in his theological outlook, and he's Anglican. So I kind of think it's a funny book that he's writing. I don't think Anglicanism ever went through the break that a lot of Reformed denominations did between a sacramental outlook and a non-sacramental outlook. I can see how, not Calvin himself, nor Luther, but I can see how Calvinists later on, especially the Puritans maybe, we discourage that way of looking at the world because of fear of idolatry.
Yeah.
But, and so you do kind of have a divorce between nature and God in the material world and God in puritanical ways of
which
thinking.
Makes people starve a lot aesthetically. It makes them aesthetically starved, and then they begin their journey back towards the reintegration
Rome
of that
or the
that
east.
Tends them to all the way to the east instead of stopping seeing that it could always be that way.
Well, there's, you know, and the problem with Rome in the east is that both of those branches destroy the essence of a sacrament. The sacrament is taking hold of a material created thing through which God communicates himself to us. But if that material thing is no longer a material thing, but it's God himself, I mean, it evacuates the whole idea of sacrament. I mean, you lose.
Yeah.
So that, and he, I think he criticizes that as well. But Anglicanism, I don't think ever lost the sacramental sense of the world. That's one of the things I love about Anglicanism. It's so material. And you don't, C.S. Lewis, he quotes C.S. Lewis a lot. C.S. Lewis is someone who grasped the mystical within the material and didn't
force them apart.
And wasn't doing anything that was antithetical to his tradition. It was, that's who Anglicans are. That's what we do.
Yeah.
So it's kind of frustrating seeing him say, well, we need to go back to this. No one's ever understood this. Or no one, when in fact, that's what Anglicanism is.
Yeah.
So
I feel like we've all been busily understanding that for a while. And
right.
The problem is that Anglicanism is full of evangelicals who come to Anglicanism and then bring their evangelicalism with them, which has split that apart.
Yeah.
And they don't understand when some of the things that you're saying to them. Like, you are just talking normally, and they impose their different categories over what you're saying and don't hear you say it. And then, you know, so I think a lot of people think that the Puritan ways of that Puritanism invaded American culture.
Right.
And divided things unnecessarily from each other. And I think when you, those categories have even come into some Catholic ways of seeing things.
But I think I think you're right about this, because when I call myself a Calvinist, I say I listen to John MacArthur, people immediately think, oh, well, you don't have a sacramental sense of the world.
Yeah.
you don't have to.
Or it's all driven by the mind. It's mind over matter. If you just have the right, I think Americans think this, if you just have the right mental categories of things, if you properly have understood something, then you will behave properly. And that's not true. Yeah. No Anglican should ever say that. Just because you know something with your mind doesn't mean in any way that you're going to obey or do the thing properly. You're not going to.
Right.
So, I think that, I mean, that's ultimately where you
get it. Your dad did not like me at first because he heard I was a Calvinist. In his mind, what he was thinking was, I'm one of those guys who am puritanical in my outlook.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to be worried about idolatry. I'm going to be worried about, breaking the second commandment.
Yeah.
With the use of graven images.
So the church is going to be plain and horrible, and we're going to throw down all our idols. And
we have totally in our minds.
Yeah. And we're just going to understand.
And that part
with our
of
minds.
Calvinism, I don't think Calvin was like that, but that part of Calvinism, I reject. The reason I call myself a Calvinist is because of his soteriology. And his understanding of salvation, which I think is brilliant, and he's a great systematic theologian. But I'm not.
But you don't. It doesn't mean that you just need to get your head
right,
everything will fall into place. Right. No, of course you need to have your mind and your body and your spirit, which are divided from each other, reintegrated through liturgical worship and through an understanding of the created order that doesn't force you to towards an extreme asceticism that makes you inhuman, right. basically, which I think a lot of people end up there. In fact, I read an article on CT about how Christians need to embrace asceticism once more. Evangelicals do.
Wow.
And I was like, especially in the same-sex debate, I thought it was an interesting article and it made a sort of a case, but I feel like it did not redress the fact of humanity.
It didn't. And, you know, it's interesting. we're going through John, our preaching series right now, and this is what Jesus does is constantly. I am the bread of life.
Yeah.
Right. So bread is good. You like bread. Bread feeds your body. It sustains you. And that bread is a picture of who I am.
Yes.
And so the material stuff that you handle and touch and taste.
When you're drinking water, when you're drawing water from the well, you're supposed to think about God.
Right. He made that water as a sign of himself.
Yes. You're not just supposed to drink water and then not experience the water in your mouth and what it's like to be thirsty and then understand that you have a deep spiritual thirst can never be quenched apart from Jesus. Like everything.
And when the wine gives you your heart joy, it's supposed to remind you of the fullness and richness and joy of Christ.
Yes.
And it's not, you know, of course. And see, the thing is, here the Puritan leaps in because you can so easily abuse those things and those things can so easily become gods. Yes.
That's
they
why
can.
You go to you confess your
but
sins.
But
God who is faithful and just will
right.
forgive you your sins.
But the last thing you want to do because of the problem of abuse of God's creatures and God's things God's created is stop using them in the way he wants you to use them.
Yeah.
That actually is
that makes
soul
it worse.
Crushing. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That makes it worse. Because you're not God. You can't do that. You can't get yourself into the right place.
Right.
You have to lean on the things that he gives you in the created order and in the church to follow him. I feel like it's not that hard, but I think it's very hard. Okay, well, our kids are almost done with soccer, so I think we should just do one quick passion verse. We just had, you're about to preach from John 10 tomorrow, right?
Yes.
So I just think we should just do, and we don't have time to respond to it, what verses are you doing in the morning?
I'm doing verses 11 through 16.
Okay, I'm going to read those. John 10, 11 through 16. I am the good shepherd who lays down my life as a sacrifice for the sheep. All right. Way to ruin one of the best verses in the Bible.
I'm trying to make it clear what I'm doing here.
Because you can't read, you dummy. But the worker who serves only for wages is not a real shepherd because he has no heart for the sheep.
Oh, no.
He will run away and abandon
them. I don't even know your heart. Do you have a heart for this?
He will run away and abandon them when he sees the wolf coming. And when the wolf mauls the sheep, drags them off, and scatters them. I alone am the good shepherd, and I know those whose hearts are mine. For they recognize me and know me, just as my Father knows my heart. There's so many hearts.
It's so many, yeah.
And I know my Father's heart. I am ready to give my life for the sheep. And I have other sheep that I will gather which are not of this Jewish flock.
It's like the Holy Spirit thinks...
God is too stupid.
Yeah, I gotta really be clear here.
I myself, the Holy Spirit, have not been clear. I will now correct myself through this person.
So I'm saying the Father knows, you know, I know my sheep like the Father, and the Father knows me and I know the Father. He's talking about, you know, the heart. And how do we know...
How do we know each other's hearts?
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad God clarified himself. I, their shepherd, must lead them too, and they will follow me and listen to my voice, and I will join them all into one flock with one shepherd. Oh, wait, 17?
No, 16.
Oh, can I just do 17?
Yeah.
My Father has an intense love for me because I freely give my own life to raise it up again.
It's not just in love. It's intense. Can we say reckless?
I think we can say reckless.
So, it's painful. The passion
so
is painful.
Pain.
Passion is full of pain.
I'm in so much pain.
Right.
And I'm not going to recover.
Yeah.
From this. There's no healing for me. So, well, anyway, I think we must collect our children. So thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back next week.